This is Shambhala Sun digital editor Rod Mead Sperry, and you're listening to Shambhala Sun Audio. Joining me on the phone today is rapper and musician Born I Music, a.k.a. Born Infinite. I've talked about his work in the Shambhala Sun and on theworsthorse.com, as he'd been in the Buddhist-influenced hip-hop duo by the name of Shambhala. Now Born has gone solo, having released the Born Identity mixtape and a brand new album called Tomorrow Is Today. Thanks for talking with me, Born.
Thank you very much. And how you doing?
I'm good. How you doing?
I'm good. I had a really awesome show last night, so I'm still riding high from the vibes.
Tell me about the show. Why was it so good?
It was one of the bigger shows that I've had since releasing my album. So I really wanted to, you know, make a statement with this performance and state my claim. And I believe that I did that. And then I ended my performance with Shambhala. I brought Agua up on stage with me, my former partner in the group I was in before. And we closed the set out with a song that everybody really loves from us, Enlightenment, Arabian Claps. It was great. It was fantastic.
Well, congratulations. I'm glad to hear it.
I appreciate it, man.
That's
thank
really
you.
Good. All right. Now, you and I have talked in the past about how you're trying to reconcile spirituality and materialism in your life and work. An opening track on Tomorrow Is Today talks about, among other things, expensive cars, but then you talk about the Buddha within. Do you feel it's difficult to reconcile these two sides of life, and even more so as a figure in the hip-hop world?
It's definitely challenging, but I think as a layperson, it's the type of challenge, for me, speaking personally, it's a worthwhile challenge to engage in, because I think a lot of times the Western Buddhist perspective tends to sort of create like a pseudo monasticism, at least in our outlook, if not in our practice. And some of the puritanical roots of this society creep their way into our Dharma practice and create this sort of like uber conservative approach to life and to, you know, what fits in to, you know, real Dharma practice. But if we read even like the oldest literature that we have in Buddhism, the Pali Canon, you know, when the Buddha was speaking to householders, he exhorted them to, you know, really strive to be as materially successful as they possibly can while maintaining the tenets of the Dharma, because who else is going to be able to support the Sangha and protect, you know, the monastic community as opposed to, you know, prosperous patrons. Now, that's not to say that there aren't, you know, people, you know, Anagarikas and people who are lay people, but really renounce a lot, you know, materially and otherwise. But prosperous people and prosperity and the promulgation of the Dharma have always kind of gone hand in hand. So I myself was sort of caught up in a very sort of strict and puritanical view of Buddhist practice for a while, and it created a lot more conflict and neurosis than was necessary. It was kind of counterproductive. So I started to question my approach and my outlook, and I felt that if Buddhist practice is really about transcending, going beyond attachment, then it's not really the object. And I think this was really what the Buddha was trying to say, was that it's not really the object that we interact with in our daily lives. It's the way that we relate to them that pose a problem. The big experiment that I'm embarking on is, you know, how can we mindfully relate to the material trappings that Western life and, you know, a more increasingly global life present us with? Because a purely monastic or physically renunciate model, I don't think it's going to work. Not for everybody, at least. So, yeah, that's a long answer to your short question. All right.
Do you feel your audience is tuning into and appreciating the more spiritual messages in your music?
Yes. My music has always been fundamentally spirituality first and music second. You know, I started to question whether or not that was really the right approach, because the people who were most responsive to the spiritual messages in my music were already spiritual people anyways. What I wanted to do as a solo artist was to sort of pique the interest of people who otherwise have not taken a look at their lives in a mindful way and say, hey, if you're driving a Ferrari or you're driving a nice car, or you're wearing designer clothes, I understand that those are things that, you know, are enjoyable, but can we take a look at it, you know, that in a way that says at the end of the day, these aren't the things that bring us true happiness. But, you know, if we have that perspective, then we can celebrate them for what they are, you know, beautiful objects that are, that provide us, you know, comfort and some measure of enjoyment, you know, in the moment. But they aren't the be all and end all to life. So I think I'm getting more of a response by kind of taking a more balanced approach than a strictly spiritual one.
So you've consciously toned down the overt spiritual themes that were prevalent in Shambhala. Was that in part due to the influence of your teacher, Bhante Buddharakhita?
I had a conversation with Bhante Buddharakhita about this, and, you know, as a disclaimer on his behalf, he's a Theravadin Buddhist monk, so he doesn't listen to music, so I wouldn't want to, you know, I use profanity in my music sometimes, and I touch on themes that a Buddhist monk would not, you know, associate himself with. So I don't want to implicate my teacher or make it seem like though he's endorsing every single word that, you know, that I'm saying. However, with that said, we've spoken at length about the nature of upaya, or skillful means. Mm-hmm. And in the Sanskrit Sutra, the Lotus Sutra, the Buddha goes through several different descriptions of ways in which he entices people to sort of come to the Dharma, or to come to looking at their lives in a more mindful way. And that's really more along the lines of what me and Bhante Buddharakhita had talked about, and just, you know, what I was thinking about also. You know, how can I, you know, use upaya, how can I use skillful means to pique people's interest in a deeper level of looking at reality, even if you are immersed in materialism? In my conversations with Bhante Buddharakhita, I would ask him, you know, does he think that it's better to sort of be overt or more subtle when presenting Dharma to the people as a whole? And he agreed that, you know, subtlety is always stronger in reaching a greater amount of people. And the way that I look at it is like, if we look at the Dharma like a jewel, right? That's one of the monikers of the Dharma, is, you know, that it's a jewel. Even the tiniest, you know, diamond is still worth, you know, 10 times more than, you know, a large object of lesser value. So if I have an entire song, you know, 4 minutes in length, but I only have, you know, 5 seconds where I say, you know, pay attention to the mind, you know, or something to that effect, that has more power than really trying to beat somebody over the head with a particular theme. You know, just dropping in a little bit of those jewels to add value to the overall offering.
Now, tell me about your own work teaching. How does that manifest?
Yeah, I teach once a month. I teach with IMCW, the Insight Meditation Community of Washington. I teach a family meditation class for kids and their families. Kids pretty much ranging anywhere from age 2 up to age 14, and then and their parents. So that's a real wide demographic of people. And that's been a really challenging and rewarding experience, because what you're trying to do is distill fairly complex themes down to the level that a child can understand, but that also an adult can appreciate. And that ties into what I'm really trying to do with my music as well, is to create sort of a universal resonance with people, you know, across all cultures and demographics. I use performance elements, you know, we do chanting, I sing. We have short meditations and talks that are usually, you know, because you're dealing with kids, you want to keep things visual and use a lot of physical comedy. I do make like music specifically for, you know, kids. I'm putting together like a CD of songs and chants and stuff like that, specifically for like my younger audience and the kids that I teach and their families and stuff. But the popular music that I make, you know, in mainstream music is not, you know, it's not for kids. I don't let my kids listen to everything that I make. So I leave the onus on the parents to make sure that, you know, they recognize that some things are for kids and some things are for adults. So yeah, another long answer.
That's cool. I don't mind a long answer. They're great. I was wondering if you have any feelings about diversity in the Buddhist community. Being somebody who's involved in, you know, you've got your influence in different places, how would you like to see things or not like to see things change?
Yeah, I was just at an Intersangha meeting at IMC in San Francisco over the summer. A big shout out to IMC and the whole California Dharma community. People from all over the country came. It was a fantastic meeting. I found myself the only black guy there, or one of them. And, you know, on the one hand, it's just natural, you know, that's kind of the way the country is broken down. You know, black folks are a minority. But on the other hand, for whatever reason, the Western Dharma community has traditionally been like a white guy's club, and then increasingly a white men and women's club, and not really too many people of color in there. And by people of color, I also mean the Asian Buddhist communities, which are not traditionally linked up with the Western Buddhist communities. The Dharma is still relatively new in the West, but I do find it to be somewhat troubling if that trend doesn't reverse itself. So I don't necessarily want to wave the flag or be the flag bearer for diversity in the Western Dharma community, but, you know, with so few people of color involved in a meaningful way, I guess I don't really have that much of a choice. That also stresses me out because, you know, I'm a rapper, I use street language, you know, et cetera. So I don't want to necessarily perpetuate any stereotypes or, you know, compound any subconscious reasonings why there aren't more black people, you know, involved in Western Dharma communities. But, you know, I can't think about that all the time. I still have to be true to myself, you know, as an artist. So I try to just be the best I can be in all of the different hats that, you know, that I wear, and hopefully people will appreciate it. I know that from my work in Shambhala, which is a hip-hop group, and, you know, we're around, you know, people of color all the time, that there's a genuine interest and a genuine, and you look at Wu-Tang Clan, I was more inspired to take a look at, you know, Eastern thought, et cetera, just growing up listening to Wu-Tang. And I know that there are tons that feel the same way. And from my experience with Shambhala, I know that there's a genuine interest in the black community for learning about meditation, practicing meditation. So I'm optimistic that things will come together.
Well, you know, I did an interview with the RZA here on Shambhala Sunspace.
He's my hero, man.
Well, he's one of mine, too. And, you know, we talked a lot about how his use of quote-unquote explicit language wasn't really so much of an issue for him, not just because of the community that he comes from, but because he saw it as skillful means and a way to communicate. And I see you as very much in that tradition.
I really appreciate it. Thank you. And even when his lyrics ventured into completely vulgar territory, you realize that he's speaking on and the overall theme of that sense of rage that's bottled up in people who come from harsh circumstances. You know, then you get to know his music more and you realize that he's not really about that, but it's just about exposing, you know, emotions and impulses, etc. So I appreciate that comparison. That's probably the dopest comparison I've ever gotten.
Oh, yeah. Well, I really want to say congratulations on your new album. I hope it's
Thank
doing
you.
Well. How is it doing?
It's doing really well because we have the luxury and the challenge of dropping the project independently. It's not like, you know, if I drop the album and I don't sell 100,000 copies in the first week, then, you know, the project is essentially scrapped. It's exciting. It's expensive. But I'm really looking forward to the future.
All right. Well, right on. Thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. All the best to you and to all the readers of and listeners to Shambhala Sun.
That was rapper and musician Born Eye Music, a.k.a. Born Infinite, joining me to talk about his new album, Tomorrow Is Today. My thanks to him for joining me for this conversation. This is Rod Mead Sperry. Thanks to you for listening to Shambhala Sun Audio.